It would be false modesty to deny that Sally Tesler and I were the bright girls of the school. Later, it was understood that I went more and more swiftly to the bad, but Sally continued being bright for some considerable time. Like many males, but few females, even among those inclined to scholarship, Sally combined a true love for the classics, the ancient ones, with an insight into mathematics which, to the small degree that I was interested, seemed to me almost magical. She won 3 scholarships, 2 gold medals, and a sojourn among the Hellenes with all expenses paid. Before she had graduated, she had published a little book of popular mathematics, which, I understood, made her a surprising sum of money. Later she edited several lesser Latin authors, published an edition so small that they can have brought her nothing but inner satisfaction. The foundations of all this erudition had almost certainly been laid in Sally's earliest childhood. The tale went that Dr. Tesler had once been the victim of some serious injustice, or considered that he had. Certainly it seemed to be true that, as his neighbors put it, he never went out. Sally herself once told me that she not only could remember nothing of her mother, but had never come across any trace or record of her. From the very beginning, Sally had been brought up, it was said, by her father alone. Rumors suggested that Dr. Tesler's regimen was threefold: reading, domestic drudgery, and obedience. I deduced that he used the last to enforce the 2 first. When Sally was not scrubbing the floor or washing up, she was studying Virgil and Euclid. Even then, I suspected that the doctor's ways of making his will felt would not have borne examination by the other parents. Certainly, however, when Sally first appeared in school, she had much more of a grounding in almost every subject taught, and in several which were not taught. Sally, therefore, was from the first a considerable irritant to the mistresses. She was always 2 years or more below the average age of her form. She had a real technique of acquiring knowledge. She respected learning in her preceptors and detected its absence. I once tried to find out in what subject Dr. Tesler had obtained his doctorate. I failed, but, of course, one then expected a German to be a doctor. It was the first school Sally had attended. I was a member of the form to which she was originally assigned, but in which she remained for less than a week, so eclipsing to the rest of us was her mass of information. She was 13 years and 5 months old at the time, nearly a year younger than I. I owe it to myself to say that I was promoted at the end of the term, and thereafter more or less kept pace with the prodigy, although this, perhaps, was for special reasons. Her hair was remarkably beautiful, a perfect light blonde and lustrous with brushing, although cut short and done in no particular way, indeed usually very untidy. She had dark eyes, a pale skin, a large distinguished nose, and a larger mouth. She had a slim but precocious figure, which later put me in mind of Tessa in The Constant Nymph. For better or for worse, there was no school uniform, and Sally invariably appeared in a dark blue dress of foreign aspect and extreme simplicity, which nonetheless distinctly became her looks. As she grew, she seemed to wear later editions of the same dress, new and enlarged, like certain publications. Sally, in fact, was beautiful, but one would be unlikely ever to meet another so lovely who was so entirely and genuinely unaware of the fact and of its implications. And of course, her casualness about her appearance and her simple clothes added to her charm. Her disposition seemed kindly and easygoing in the extreme, and her voice was lazy to drawling. But Sally, nonetheless, seemed to live only in order to work, and although I was, I think, her closest friend, it was the urge to keep up with her which explained much of my own progress in school, I learned very little about her. She seemed to have no pocket money at all, as this amounted to a social deficiency of the vastest magnitude, and as my parents could afford to be, and were, generous, I regularly shared with her. She accepted the arrangement simply and warmly. In return, she gave me frequent little presents of books, a copy of Goethe's Faust in the original language, bound in somewhat discouraging brown leather, and an edition of Petronius, with some remarkable drawings. Much later, when in need of money for a friend, I took the Faust, in no hopeful spirit, to Sotheby's, where it proved to be a rebound first edition. But it was a conversation about the illustrations in the Petronius. I was able to construe Latin fairly well for a girl, but the italics and long S's daunted me, which led me to the discovery that Sally knew more than any of us about the subjects illustrated. Despite her startling range of information, she seemed then, and certainly for long after, completely disinterested in any personal way. It was as if she discoursed in the gentlest, sweetest manner about some distant, far-off thing, or, to use a comparison absurdly hackneyed but here appropriate, about botany. It was an ordinary enough school, and sex was a preoccupation among us. Sally's attitude was surprisingly new and unusual. In the end, she did ask me not to tell the others what she had just told me. "As if I would," I replied challengingly, but still musingly. And in fact, I didn't tell anyone until considerably later, when I found that what I had learned from Sally were things which no one else at all seemed to know, things which I sometimes think have in themselves influenced my life, so to say, not a little. Once I tried to work out how old Sally was at the time of this conversation. I think she could hardly have been more than 15. In the end, Sally won her university scholarship, and I just failed. But I won the school's English Essay Prize and also the Good Conduct Medal, which I deemed, and still deem, in the nature of a stigma, but believed, consolingly, to be awarded more to my prosperous father than to me. Sally's conduct was in any case better than mine, being indeed irreproachable. I had entered for the scholarship with the intention of forcing the examiners, in the unlikely event of my winning it, to bestow it upon Sally, who really needed it. When this doubtless impracticable scheme proved unnecessary, Sally and I parted company, she to her triumphs of the intellect, I to my lesser achievements. We corresponded intermittently, but decreasingly, as our areas of common interest diminished. Ultimately, for a very considerable time, I lost sight of her altogether, although occasionally over the years I used to see reviews of her learned books and encounter references to her in leading articles about the Classical Association and similar indispensable bodies. I took it for granted that by now we should have difficulty in communicating at all. I observed that Sally did not marry. One couldn't wonder, I foolishly and unkindly drifted into supposing. When I was 41, two things happened which have a bearing on this narrative. The first was that a catastrophe befell me, which led to my again taking up residence with my parents. Details are superfluous. The second thing was the death of Dr. Tesler. I should probably have heard of Dr. Tesler's death in any case, for my parents, who, like me and the rest of the neighbors, had never set eyes on him, had always regarded him with mild curiosity. As it was, the first I knew of it was when I saw the funeral. I was shopping on behalf of my mother, and reflecting upon the vileness of things, when I observed old Mr. Orbit remove his hat, in which he always served, and briefly sink his head in prayer. Between the aggregations of shredded wheat in the window, I saw the passing shape of a very old-fashioned, and therefore very ornate, horse-drawn hearse. It bore a coffin covered in a pall of worn purple velvet, but there seemed to be no mourners at all. "Didn't think I'd ever see a horse hearse again, Mr. Orbit," remarked old Mrs. Rind, who was always ahead of me in queue. "Pauper funeral, I expect," said her friend, old Mrs. Edge. "No such thing any more," said Mr. Orbit quite sharply, replacing his hat. "That's Dr. Tesler's funeral. I don't suppose he had any family come to look after things." I believe the three white heads then got together and began to whisper. But on hearing the name, I had made towards the door. I looked out. The huge ancient hearse, complete with vast black plumes, looked much too big for the narrow autumnal street. It put me in mind of how toys are often so grossly out of scale with one another. I could now see that instead of mourners, a group of urchins, shadowy in the fading light, ran behind the bier, shrieking and jeering, a most regrettable scene in a well-conducted township. For the first time in months, if not years, I wondered about Sally. 3 days later, she appeared without warning at my parents' front door. It was I who opened it. "Hello, Mel." One hears of people who, after many years, take up conversation as if the same number of hours had passed. This was the case in point. Sally, moreover, looked almost wholly unchanged. Possibly her lustrous hair was one half shade darker, but it was still short and wild. Her lovely white skin was unwrinkled. Her large mouth smiled sweetly, but, as always, somewhat absently. She was dressed in the most ordinary clothes, but still managed to look like anything but a don or a dominie, although neither did she look like a woman of the world. It was, I reflected, hard to decide what she did look like. "Hello, Sally." I kissed her and began to condole. "Father really died before I was born, you know that." I have heard something. I should not have been sorry to hear more, but Sally threw off her coat, sank down before the fire, and said, I've read all your books. I love them. I should have written. Thank you, I said. I wish there were more who felt like you. You're an artist, Mel. You can't expect to be a success at the same time. She was warming her white hands. I was not sure that I was an artist, but it was nice to be told. There was a circle of leather-covered armchairs round the fire. I sat down beside her. I've read about you often in the Times Lit, I said, but that's all, for years, much too long. I'm glad you're still living here, she replied. Not still, again. Oh? She smiled in her gentle, absent way. Following a session in the frying pan and another one in the fire, I'm sure you've been conducting yourself more sensibly. I was still fishing. But all she said was, anyway, I'm still glad you're living here. Can't say I am. But why in particular? Silly Mel, because I'm going to live here too. I had never even thought of it. I could not resist a direct question. Who told you your father was ill? A friend. I've come all the way from Asia Minor. I've been looking at potsherds. She was remarkably untanned for one who had been living under the sun, but her skin was of the kind which does not tan readily. It would be lovely to have you about again. Lovely, Sally. But what will you do here? What do you do? I write. In other ways, my life is rather over, I feel. I write, too, sometimes. At least I edit. And I don't think my life, properly speaking, has ever begun. I had spoken in self-pity, although I had not wholly meant to do so, but the tone of her reply I found impossible to define. Certainly, I thought with slight malice, certainly she does look absurdly virginal. A week later, a van arrived at Dr. Tesler's house, containing a great number of books, a few packed trunks, and little else, and Sally moved in. She offered no further explanation for this gesture of semi-retirement from the gay world, for we lived about 40 miles from London, too many for urban participation, too few for rural self-sufficiency. But it occurred to me that Sally's resources were doubtless not so large that she could disregard an opportunity to live rent-free, although I had no idea whether the house was a freehold, and there was no mention even of a will. Sally was, and always had been, so vague about practicalities that I was a little worried about these matters, but she declined ideas of help. There was no doubt that if she were to offer the house for sale, she could not expect from the proceeds an income big enough to enable her to live elsewhere, and I could imagine that she shrank from the bother and uncertainty of letting. I heard about the contents of the van from Mr. Ditch, the remover, and it was, in fact, not until she had been in residence for about 10 days that Sally sent me an invitation. During this time, after she had refused my help with her affairs, I had thought it best to leave her alone. Now, although the house, which I must thenceforth think of as hers, stood only about a quarter of a mile from the house of my parents, she sent me a postcard. It was a picture postcard of Mittelheim. She asked me to tea. The way was through the avenues and round the corners of a mid-19th century housing estate for merchants and professional men. My parents' house was intended for the former, Sally's for the latter. It stood, in fact, at the very end of a cul-de-sac. Even now, the house opposite bore the plate of a dentist. I had often stared at the house during Dr. Tesler's occupancy and before I knew Sally, but not until that day did I enter it. The outside looked much as it had ever done. The house was built in a gray brick, so depressing that one speculated how anyone could ever come to choose it, as many once did, however, throughout the home counties. To the right of the front door, approached by 12 steps with blue and white tessellated risers, protruded a greatly disproportionate obtuse angled bay window. It resembled the thrusting nose on a gray and wrinkled face. This bay window served the basement, the ground floor, and the first floor. Between the two latter ran a dull red string course in an acanthus pattern, like a chaplet round the temples of a dowager. From the second floor window, it might have been possible to step onto the top of the projecting bay, the better to view the surgery opposite, had not the second floor window been barred, doubtless as protection for a nursery. The wooden gate had fallen from its hinges and had to be lifted open and shut. It was startlingly heavy. The bell was in order. Sally was, of course, alone in the house. Immediately she opened the door, which included 2 large tracts of colored glass. I apprehended a change in her, essentially the first change in all the time I had known her. For the woman who had come to my parents' house a fortnight or 3 weeks before had seemed to be very much the girl who had joined my class when we were both children. But now there was a difference. In the first place, she looked different. Previously, there had always been a distinction about her appearance, however inexpensive her clothes. Now she wore a fawn jumper which needed washing, and stained, creaseless gray slacks. When a woman wears trousers, they need to be smart, and these were slacks indeed. Sally's hair was not so much picturesquely untidy as in the past, but more truly in bad need of trimming. She wore distasteful sandals, and her expression had altered. "Hello, Mel. Do you mind sitting down and waiting for the kettle to boil?" She showed me into the ground floor room, although to make possible the basement, it was cocked high in the air, with the bay window. "Just throw your coat on a chair." She bustled precipitately away. It occurred to me that Sally's culinary aplomb had diminished since her busy childhood of legend. The room was horrible. I had expected eccentricity, discomfort, bookworminess, even perhaps the slightly macabre. But the room was entirely commonplace, and in the most unpleasing fashion. The furniture had probably been mass-produced in the early 20s. It was of the kind which it is impossible, by any expenditure of time and polish, to keep in good order. The carpet was dingy jazz. There were soulless little pictures in gilt frames. There were dreadful modern knick-knacks. There was a wireless set, obviously long broken. For the time of year, the rickety, smoky fire offered none too much heat. Rejecting Sally's invitation, I drew my coat about me. There was nothing to read except a pre-war copy of Titbits which I found on the floor under the lumpy settee. Like Sally's jumper, the dense lace curtains could have done with a wash. But before long, Sally appeared with tea, 6 uniform pink cakes from the nearest shop, and a flavorless liquid full of floating strangers. The crockery accorded with the other appurtenances. I asked Sally whether she had started work of any kind. "Not yet," she replied, a little dourly. "I've got to get things going in the house first." "I suppose your father left things in a mess?" She looked at me sharply. "Father never went out of his library." She seemed to suppose that I knew more than I did. Looking round me, I found it hard to visualize a library. I changed the subject. "Aren't you going to find it rather a big house for one?" It seemed a harmless, though uninspired, question. But Sally, instead of answering, simply sat staring before her, although it was more as if she stared within her at some unpleasant thought. I believe in acting upon impulse. "Sally," I said, "I've got an idea. Why don't you sell this house, which is much too big for you, and come and live with me? We've plenty of room, and my father is the soul of generosity." She only shook her head. "Thank you, Mel, no." She still seemed absorbed by her own thoughts, disagreeable thoughts. "You remember what you said the other day about being glad I was living here. I'm likely to go on living here. I'd love to have you with me, Sally. Please think about it." She put down her ugly little tea plate on the ugly little table. She had taken a single small bite out of her pink cake. She stretched out her hand toward me, very tentatively, not nearly touching me. She gulped slightly. "Mel," I moved to take her hand, but she drew it back. Suddenly she shook her head violently. Then she began to talk about her work. She did not resume eating or drinking, and indeed both the cakes and the tea, which every now and then she pressed upon me in a casual way more like her former manner, were remarkably unappetizing. But she talked interestingly and familiarly for half an hour, about indifferent matters. And then she said, "Forgive me, Mel, but I must be getting on." She rose. I rose too. Then I hesitated. "Sally, please think about it. I'd like it so much. Please." "Thank you, Mel. I'll think about it. Promise?" "Promise. Thank you for coming to see me. I want to see much more of you." She stood in the open front door. In the dusk, she looked inexplicably harassed and woebegone. "Come and see me whenever you want. Come to tea tomorrow and stay to dinner." Anything to get her out of that horrible, horrible house. But as before, she only said, "I'll think about it." Walking home, it seemed to me that she could only have invited me out of obligation. I was much hurt and much frightened by the change in her. As I reached my own gate, it struck me that the biggest change of all was that she had never once smiled. When 5 or 6 days later, I had neither seen nor heard from Sally, I wrote asking her to visit me. For several days, she did not reply at all. Then she sent me another picture postcard, this time of some ancient bust in a museum, informing me that she would love to come when she had a little more time. I noticed that she had made a slight error in my address, which she had hastily and imperfectly corrected. The postman, of course, knew me. I could well imagine that there was much to do in Sally's house. Indeed, it was a house of the kind in which the work is never either satisfying or complete, an ever-open mouth of a house. But despite the tales of her childhood, I could not imagine the Sally I knew doing it. I could not imagine what she was doing. And I admit that I did want to know. Sometime after that, I came across Sally in the international stores. It was not a shop I usually patronized, but Mr. Orbit was out of my father's particular pickles. I could not help wondering whether Sally did not remember perfectly well that it was a shop in which I was seldom found. She was there when I entered. She was wearing the same grimy slacks, and this time a white blouse, which was worse than her former jumper, being plainly filthy. Against the autumn, she wore a blue raincoat, which I believed to be the same that she had worn to school. She looked positively unkempt and far from well. She was nervously shoveling a little heap of dark blue bags and gaudy packets into a very ancient hold-all. Although the shop was fairly full, no one else was waiting to be served at the part of the counter where Sally stood. I walked up to her. "Good morning, Sally." She clutched the ugly hold-all to her, as if I were about to snatch it. Then at once she became ostentatiously relaxed. "Don't look at me like that," she said. There was an upsetting little rasp in her voice. "After all, Mel, you're not my mother." Then she walked out of the shop. "Your change, miss," cried the international store's shopman after her. But she was gone. The other women in the shop watched her go as if she were the town tart. Then they closed up along the section of the counter where she had been standing. "Poor thing," said the shopman unexpectedly. He was young. The other women looked at him malevolently and gave their orders with conscious briskness. Then came Sally's accident. By this time there could be no doubt that something was very much wrong with her. But I had always been very nearly her only friend in the town, and her behavior to me made it difficult for me to help. It was not that I lacked will, or, I think, courage, but that I was unable to decide how to set about the task. I was still thinking about it when Sally was run over. I imagine that her trouble, whatever it was, had affected her ordinary judgment. Apparently she stepped right under a lorry in the high street, having just visited the post office. I learned shortly afterwards that she refused to have letters delivered at her house, but insisted upon them being left post-restante. When she had been taken to the cottage hospital, the matron, Miss Garvis, sent for me. Everyone knew that I was Sally's friend. "Do you know who is her next of kin?" "I doubt whether she has such a thing in this country." "Friends?" "Only me that I know of." I had always wondered about the mysterious informant of Dr. Tesler's passing. Miss Garvis considered for a moment. "I'm worried about her house. Strictly speaking, in all the circumstances, I suppose I ought to tell the police and ask them to keep an eye on it. But I am sure she would prefer me to ask you." From her tone, I rather supposed that Miss Garvis knew nothing of the recent changes in Sally, or perhaps she thought it best to ignore them. "As you live so close, I wonder if it would be too much to ask you to just look in every now and then. Perhaps daily might be best." I think I accepted, mainly because I suspected that something in Sally's life might need, for Sally's sake, to be kept from the wrong people. Here are her keys. It was a numerous assembly for such a commonplace establishment as Sally's. "I'll do it as I say, Miss Garvis, but how long do you think it will be?" "Hard to say, but I don't think Sally's going to die."